Hello, everybody, and welcome to Pod Stallions. I am Brian, and with me to my very, very far left, I can't see him, is Jason.
Hello, everyone.
And this week, we have decided to watch The Watchmen and talk about this seminal, groundbreaking comic and its many iterations and its impact. Some 35 years later, is it 35 years old?
86. So
goodness, yeah.
Yeah.
Now, did you get in on this comic on the ground floor? Were you there day one?
I was trying to think of this because, you know, 86. I wasn't really frequenting comic shops at that point, because as you know, I had so many ladies at that point.
Your medallion years.
I simply had no time.
Yes.
But I remember distinctly the but what I did have as a strapping young 15-year-old was a subscription to Rolling Stone. I think I got it my like freshman year or something, and it was, you know, I got it for the articles.
Why else would you get it?
There was that big article on The Dark Knight Returns, and so I was trying to figure out, you know, kind of going backwards, when I picked up Dark Knight Returns, which would have led to Watchmen. But whenever the trade paperback out, that's when I got it. I knew of it before, but I did not pick up the individual issue. Wouldn't have been something that I was hyper aware of at that time. So I wasn't following it over the course of the year or whatever. Did you get it as a single issue thing?
No. At that time, I was not. 86, I was actually starting to collect old toys. So I was frequenting comic shops, but not for new books.
Right.
I was occasionally helping a friend out running cash and that sort of thing. But I don't think I really cared. I was aware of it. I remember being aware of it. Because it was hard. I read Comic Buyer's Guide for the toy ads.
Mm.
And I always liked reading about comics more than I did reading them. And but I hadn't picked up the comic. I'd heard it was dark. And I just really wasn't that into it. I got into it actually in the 90s.
Mm.
When I started, believe it or not, I was taking karate in the back of a comic book store.
Oh, that's wild.
And, you know, the owner and I got to be pretty chummy. And well, I knew him before, but he was just recommending books I'd like.
Mm-hmm.
And I was picking up trades, and I picked up The Watchmen, you know, probably at like 25. Mm-hmm. So I was a little late to the party. Mm-hmm. But mind you, I kind of knew who the characters were, and you know, it wasn't like the story was blown for me or anything like that. And I certainly was familiar with both Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons because they met at and this is a callback at Doctor Who magazine.
That's right. That's my.
Yeah.
I was trying to figure that out when I first read Alan Moore, or kind of knew who he was, what the name was,
and yeah,
that was the connection. Like without knowing, once I'm reading Watchmen, instantly I recognize the art and go, that guy did Tom Baker. I know this guy did.
Yeah,
Tom
Baker. I like Dave Gibbons' art too.
I love his art. I love his art. I love the, because you see it and you know who it is. There's a lot of stuff out there, especially the last 15, 20 years that. You put it in front of me, and I'm like, I don't know. Is it Jim Lee? I think it's Jim Lee. Whereas a Dave Gibbons, you know that's Dave Gibbons. And so I went, you know, I went and grabbed my old issues of, you know, Doctor Who Weekly or whatever at the time to look up the, or maybe it was even grabbing the reprints, the first four reprints maybe, or the ones that came out, and just doing a comparison and knowing that, you know, that's who this was. So, but it was the kind of thing that as I went along with it, reading it, that it was, you know, there's no way to talk about Watchmen unless you hate it or something. If you like it and you admire it and appreciate it, there's no way to talk about it that doesn't sound like a cliche or like you're repeating something that's already been drilled home, you know, for 30 years about it. But it was what blew my mind was those chapter breaks, because there were no ads in the single issues, and of course there's nothing in the trade. But when it would, you know, every chapter or two you'd have the black freighter thing, yeah, but like here's an excerpt from Under the Hood, you know, and it's four or five.
Yeah.
Here's an excerpt of the Rorschach file, and you're suddenly reading, you know, three or four pages of the Rorschach file, and without that, you don't know what's so special about the mask. It's in the Rorschach file that you figure out, or you're told what the material is and how it was got into his hands and everything, or different articles that were in there. That's the stuff that really knocked me out. Like, oh man, this is a completely different experience.
There's a lot going on in the back too. There's so much going on. Like, I remember reading it once and just reading what the side characters are saying, you know, and you notice it a lot. And I'm assuming everyone's read this by now. If you aren't, then skip ahead.
Yeah, spoilers, Watchmen spoilers ahead. We're going to talk about every bit of this thing. And so
yeah.
If you've read it or seen it or seen the show, stop this and go do that now.
Yeah, we'll wait.
Yeah, we'll wait.
So when the apocalypse there is happening, you know, the big space aliens coming down, all these side characters that you really don't know anything about are having like their own squabbles and problems, and you know, and you're just sitting there like, yeah, this is like the real world. Like everyone's in their own little world here, and found that really interesting.
That aspect even threw me a bit because I don't think I'd ever read something like that where, you know, you're following the conversation, the back and forth between the news agent and the kid
who's sitting there
in the thing. And as I'm reading it, I remember this the very first time, as I'm reading it, I'm thinking this is all going to come into play down the road. Like these conversations are going to be important in some way down the road. And they're not. They're just giving you some realism to it and commentary on, you know, what's happening in the world, sort of. And that I'd never seen before, where you've just got this, you know, casual conversations, as Supertramp would say, between people that you think is going to be important, an important plot point, but isn't really, you know. You know, and of course, like I'm sure most people that read it or that are interested in the things we're interested in, when you get to the bit when you meet Ozymandias with the reporter, and on his desk he's got some Ozymandias action figures. I think there's action figures, and I think there's a maybe like a prototype of Bubastis or something, the cat, the modified, something like that.
I think there's a Dylan action figures too.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. And he's got like a box on his desk and a couple things. And I just remember going, oh my God, that's cool. Like, I wonder if someone's going to make these.
Do you know that Paul Clark made a, I think, I can't remember which character, but he made a custom Mego for the film.
Oh man.
That unfortunately got cut.
Oh, to be in the film?
Yeah.
Oh no, I didn't know
that. Yeah, he had to overnight it to Zack Snyder. He told me that like a week ago. And
oh man, because that would have been a perfect spot to have it, like on his
yeah. And I forget, he told me, and I can't remember the whole story now, but he had to overnight it in one day, and it probably was like a Rorschach or I don't know, but somebody, like, he knew somebody in California ordered all these parts, and he's like, you're making a Watchmen character, and they said, yeah, we're working on the movie, and he goes, yeah, I figured, because it's Hollywood, and he tells the story better. I'll have to ask him again, but
that I'd love to know
what the
character was or more about that. That's fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah.
So So it got cut. It definitely got cut.
Yeah, it did. I don't think, I think I'm going to look and see if it's in the cut scenes on the Blu-ray, but I don't think it was there. I'd have remembered because I've gone through that Blu-ray a couple times. But we'll get to that.
It definitely knocked me out. Like, it really was.
It's incredibly meta. And I think the backstory of this, right? Like, DC bought all the Charlton superheroes.
Yeah.
Mainly, I think, because Dick Gorgiano, I'm mangling his name, worked at Charlton.
Then
Alan Moore came with this proposal, and he's like, I'm not killing off all my heroes.
They just got over here. What are you talking about?
Yeah. And then they made this this new universe. And that's one of the things I really like about the Watchmen universe is between the Gibbons art and the writing, this is completely, you're not reading this and going, this is a Marvel book or this is a DC book. It's really its own thing. It's just by happenstance, I think, has a unique everything to it.
And when we think of it, it's so fashionable now to deconstruct such things. Like, it is.
Oh, yeah.
What does it mean if somebody does this and then they go out and do that and whatever with, in the world of superheroes. But I'm going to say we got some of that with Marvel Man, or Miracle Man,
recalling. Yeah.
Yeah. With, again, more deconstructing a character, but he's, and Swamp Thing, of course, he did. But I hadn't read those yet. Like, I hadn't really gotten to those before Watchmen, I don't think. But it was a radical thing to do with brand new characters, and I'm saying it's now become so almost passé to. There's been so many things done, not just outside of Marvel and DC, where it's a, there's one right now with Stallone, that's an Amazon
Prime. Yeah, I saw that. I forget what it's called.
With an S.
See, yeah, I can't. No, I can't remember.
Samaritan, that's it.
It was in Samaritan. To me, that would have been like one of the best superhero movies I saw in the 90s. It's bad, but
no, it was I thought it was going to be bad, but I actually thought it was pretty good. The kid was good, but it was nice to see Stallone acting. It was nice to see him, cuz I got the director's cut of Copland, which I never saw the director's cut. I hadn't seen the movie in about 6-7 years maybe, and I think that's damn near perfect. But Stallone is so good in it, besides the rest of the cast and the script and everything, James Mangold. Stallone is so good in Copland. He's the center of the story, but he never pulls the spotlight. I don't think he ever raises his voice. He barely gets, two sentences out each line kind of thing. And he's incredible. And I just seeing it again, I was sort of disappointed in, like, I wish he would have done more things,
Stallone actually said something that wrecked his career for a while, and
it's the thing hands down that he gets the most, outside of the first Rocky, the thing that he gets the most praise for as an actor is Copland, and that's why he
went and Rhinestone
Stop or My Mom Will Shoot, which people don't realize was a drama. They just marketed it as a comedy. It was really a drama.
It was more of a dramedy.
A dramedy. So anyways, the Samaritan thing is just like, there's so much of that. There's so much original content that isn't with the big two that sort of deconstructs superheroes that at the time what this thing was doing really, again, everything we're going to say is a cliche about this book, but it was radical. It was, kind of mind blowing. And what was your take when you first read the whole thing? Did you go, I guess, or did you go, wow?
I went, wow. The story, I think I went, wow, when I read it again. And it's a comic I've picked up many times and looked over and over again because it's not a feel good story, but it's well written, it's well crafted, and you notice something new every time you pick it up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and one of the things I think Grant Morrison once said about it was, you know, it's a loop of a story too.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, it's told from Rorschach's perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the end, that schlubby guy in the newspaper office gets his journal.
Yeah.
So you're going to start over again, you know? So I, you know, and it's very much of its time too. Like, you know, they've created a world that is purposely otherworldly. Like, you know, Dr. Manhattan's changed a lot of things. People dress very strangely in the world. You know, like clothing's weird. What is it? There's no gas anymore. Everyone's just using, you know, atomic energy.
Cigarettes aren't, you know, you don't smoke a pack anymore. It's like a long thing that's much more healthy for you. And that's to me one of the strokes of genius of it, is that it's our world, but different. It's this kind of setting that really works, because you can get away with, you know, President Redford and, you know, a candidate. Redford was running at that point. Nixon was still president, third term, et cetera, et cetera. So you have the familiarity. And, you know, I think people also sort of forget or take for granted that the subject matter, you know, Russia and the U.S. being on the verge of nuclear holocaust was a really very scary thing. Like, it was a thing that every time you see the cover of Time magazine or something, you think, okay, well, this is going to happen. Like, any second, just two guys sitting in a room going to press a button and that's it.
And all that. I mean, two tribes. Land of Confusion. We had a lot of songs about the apocalypse.
That's right. The chant has begun. 42.
Yeah.
I forget that one. So all of that. And I when I finished it, I was wow. Like, it really like knocked me out. And I had to, I think I read it again a couple months later, because I just went, I know I've missed some stuff. You know, I might have even like skipped one of the supplemental things, just thought, oh, this probably isn't important. You know, and then went back and
I probably skimmed over the pirate stuff. I always like that too, is that the biggest comics in a world full of superheroes are pirate comics.
Right.
Which, you know, obviously is a very underperforming genre here. I mean, I think EC Comics published a few pirate comics, but I don't know if there was any long running interest in that.
It was years before I understood why it was in there. Like, reading it the first time, I didn't understand what it was doing in there. I thought it was, if anything, it was paralleling some of the paranoia and the anxiety that was to come in the story. But I didn't know for years that the reason he chose, you know, pirate comics was because, you know, why would people want to read comics of, if heroes existed, why would they want to read comics of them or something? Which is why the thing, the scope of it too, you were talking about the scope of it. The fact that Moore, and these were, and correct me if I'm wrong, but 9 panels on each page, which was not the norm for comic books. So there's 9 panels, so 3-3-3, and they used a different color palette as well for this book. Lots of, you know, sort of reflections of light, purples.
It's beautiful. I love the colors in that comic.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it all goes together with what made it look and seem so different. You know, and there's also a thing with Moore that his sense of humor. Now, he's a complicated man, and no one understands him but his woman.
But his woman, yeah.
But he's a complicated man in some ways. I think he is a bona fide genius, what he did. You know, to be fair, as critical as he is of everything, and now comic books in general, like get off my lawn kind of thing, everything he did was other people's creations. everything he...
At the time, yeah, but that's because he wanted to play in those sandboxes.
Right, so, you know, Superman, everyone talks about the Superman story. Everyone talks about the Swamp Thing run. Miracle Man, you know, Watchmen, obviously riffing on existing characters. You know, he... So I always think it's ironic that he, you know, League of Extraordinary Gentlemen is all, they're all original creations of other authors. Mm-hmm. It's interesting that he's, you know, very so critical about what is done with his stuff. You know, From Hell is a real story, you know, an actual thing that happened. And but anyway, but he his direction of Gibbons was so intense, and so in every bit of that thing. I mean, Gibbons brought his own stuff to it as well, but the fact that Moore is typing away on this stuff, and at the same time has all the images. He knows where he wants to go with these stories, or how, you know. I mean, it's all in the direction of the script too. You know, from the first cover, and that's another thing I think is that each cover is the first panel of that issue, which I'd never seen before.
Yeah.
Instead of a cover that is like, you know, Luke and Ben punching a guy in the cantina, you know, that's never
get out of here, Ben.
Yeah.
This dialogue that we never saw in the movie.
Yeah. Keep swinging that lightsaber, Ben.
Yeah.
the thing like that never shows up in the story. This thing was, you know, the cover was the first panel of the story, which is insane. So there's the book, and I don't remember if I ever found any merchandise at comic shops. I remember seeing a watch that came out when the book came out. I thought
there was metal miniatures.
I remember I actually had those once. I don't know what happened.
I don't know if the watch was a big deal. My local comic shop has had a Watchmen clock in it since, I don't know, since the book came out. It's still there. sorry, I had to cough there.
I mean, there might have been like a t-shirt or two, maybe. Like, I'm just trying to think of the whatever little merchandise there was.
You never got merchandise really that often. Remember how hard it was to find a superhero t-shirt?
Yeah, I was thinking maybe the first one I had as a slightly more grown human would have been for Batman or something. I probably had a Batman shirt for that one. That movie.
Oh, of course. Yeah, that's when everybody had a Batman shirt. But
there wasn't go ahead.
But there was movie buzz right off the bat.
Yes.
And I believe it was Terry Gilliam and Sam Hamm was writing it. And I can honestly remember like an interview with Alan Moore. And he, you know, this is young, innocent, full of optimism, Alan Moore, you know, who's all excited about it. But, you know, that was before, I think, DC and Hollywood just made him hard, you know. I empathize with Alan Moore. I think more than a lot of creators. It's like, you know, that old saying, who hurt you? Oh, they hurt you. Oh, those guys over there. Yeah, okay, I see it, you know. I just sort of have this empathy for him. I see what happened to him.
I do to a degree. I get the artist aspect. You know, it's the same as Harlan Ellison from City on the Edge of Forever forward. The second somebody tweaks it or does something different, they blow a gasket. But they're
I can't stand Ellison. Is a different story.
I know, they're not the same man. I'm saying they both take issue with making changes. To I mean, Moore always has said that. Some of the reason he tells stories the way he does is because they can only be told in the medium that he chose, in the comic
book. True enough. Yeah.
He would try to. And that's a quote that I remember from, you know, well before, you know, HBO and Netflix type series where everything has changed in the long form telling of a story. There wasn't that option really. And so I first read about Gilliam's name, but it had to be early 90s when that kept floating around. And then allegedly, you know, in another interview with Moore, maybe on his 50th or whatever that was, someone asked Gilliam, what would you do? How would you make this thing? And he said, well, I wouldn't. Like, there's no way to make this movie. There's no way to make this whole thing as a movie. Gilliam might have suggested a miniseries, like a network type miniseries.
Yeah, I was going to suggest that too. I think this would have been an amazing 12 part HBO miniseries.
Oh, can you imagine?
Yeah. Because it's just got so much to pack in there.
Yeah.
And what do you cut? You know, that's the problem with a lot of Hollywood adaptations of things is this is a 2-hour movie.
Right.
And, you know, I think Snyder did a very good job with it. And, you know, he certainly made it 3 hours long.
Yeah.
Which, okay.
What I was going to say was, by the time Gilliam sort of, that thing starts to dissolve, I mean, I think just about every studio in town had Watchmen at one time or another. Everybody tried to get this thing off the ground multiple times with multiple directors and multiple writers. And it just, they couldn't figure out how to do it or what the scope would be. And Snyder at that point had the remake of Dawn of the Dead, which did very, very well. And I think
he was kind of a golden boy.
Yeah, I thought it was a great remake. As remakes go and that kind of thing, I thought it was great. Might have been was that the first one where zombies went fast? Is that the one that everybody points to?
I'd argue it's not the first, but that's real semantics. It's definitely the biggest film where we had fast moving zombies. I mean, Return of the Living Dead, they were kind of moving pretty fast too.
Right. So that comes out, does very well. Then he does 300. I think that was the only other film he did, the second one. And that did really well. I think you had Sin City, which was, you know, fairly low budget. Rodriguez did everything. That was huge. And I think 300 followed it.
Yeah, and this is where Hollywood can't seem to think on its own two feet, is that they get a guy who directed a good comic book movie. And then they're like, well, you can direct all comic book movies.
Right.
You know, well, yeah. And I'm not saying Snyder did 300 justice. And, you know, he did a good job on The Watchmen, although I think he missed its tone. Handing him Superman was weird.
Yeah. But let's get to Watchmen, because you get these two movies that do very well. It seemed to be, in hindsight, like a natural thing for them to go, we've got this property, we're not sure how to do it. You clearly are having luck with genre stuff, you know.
Yeah.
And I understand there are detractors out there. I don't really know anyone that despises that movie or hates it. I think it's fantastic. I've talked about it plenty on this show. It gets better each time I see it. And I'll fight anyone on each point if they like, verbally. But at the end of the day, what people need to remember and as an appreciation is just what you said. It's a 2-hour-and-45-minute movie. It was $180 million. And he didn't compromise a bit. And for all those years that everybody said, you'll be able to do it, it'll never happen. Or, you know what, Hollywood's going to get it, turn it into a Happy Meal. They're going to get Tom Cruise. It was never, everybody was so uptight about how badly it was going to be ruined. Now here comes a guy that says, I'm going to be faithful to the book. Obviously, I'm not going to get every single thing in there. And then he even went further to the studio and said, oh, and I also want to do the animated thing. We can put that out as a DVD, as a separate thing before the movie comes out, you know, and he got to do multiple cuts and all this stuff. It is a massive achievement. And I think they had over 200 practical sets in that movie. So that whole New York street thing is all practical. When you think about 300 and a lot of the stuff he did after Watchmen, you just get the sense that it's two people on a plank of wood with a bunch of green around it, and they never go anywhere to do anything. Watchmen, you know, the proof is in the pudding. And then you get to the cast. And, you know, there was never going to be something that was going to attract, you know, A-list, because there goes, you know, a 30-year budget or something. I thought he did a wonderful job with the cast, especially Rorschach and Billy Crudup, which I appreciate more and more as the years go on, because he's so stoic. He's so perfect. And just side note, the CGI of Dr. Manhattan from 2009 is better than the CGI for She-Hulk 2022. That's all I'm going to say. I think it's incredible. I think, like I say, like with the book, each time I see it, I see something else that I go, oh, I didn't notice that book on there. I didn't notice the squid or the name of the system that Ozymandias to do whatever. You know, and, oh, that's supposed to be, that's Annie Leibovitz, and that's supposed to be the little Easter eggs that are all throughout there, too. I mean, it was a mammoth undertaking. And mileage may vary, I get it, but if he had made a 90-minute or 2-hour PG-13 film, it would have done double the business, but he would have been crucified for it. So I can crucify him for plenty after Watchmen, but I will stand by him always for what he pulled off with that film, and I think it's incredible.
Yeah. I don't hate the film. I like the film. I own it. And I walked out of the theater thinking, that's the best you're going to get.
That's a great way to put it.
Like, is it devoted to the book? It tries very hard to follow the book. I think he's missed the mark tonally a few times. You know, because I one of the biggest things I have is the portrayal of Rorschach. And I think Jackie Earle Haley was brilliant as the character. I think it's a wonderful job. But there's just, you know, I think from what I've read of Moore and from what I looked at the book, Rorschach is not to be aggrandized. He's a creep. And
but see, I don't think he's romanticized in the film. He is. Everyone calls him a psychopath, you know, like what's her, Silk Spectre says he's a lunatic or he's psycho or something. They should lock you up, blah, blah, blah. We see how black and white he is. We know he's a fascist. I mean, he's black or white. You know, I think Moore even said it's interesting. It's like, you know, I remember all the interviews with Sting with Every Breath You Take, where it ends up being the biggest movie of that year, or biggest song of that year, and he got some certificate of, like, this certifies it's got 1 million plays on radio. And he's like, you know, it's a song about possession. It's a song about kind of a creepy dude who wants to possess, like, he's not letting someone alone. Like, it's not a love song. It's not a romance. And he never understood why people didn't get, it's very much like Born in the USA. Everyone used it as campaign music, and it was like, that's not what it's about. So Moore was always kind of fascinated that people were drawn to Rorschach because he's not a likable character. On the other hand, he's really fucked up. Like, he had a really bad childhood and was on his own for a long time. And his morality is what it is. But if you want, you know, you can, it's written in a way that you can kind of understand where it comes from. But I think the thing is, he looks amazing. He looks and sounds cool in every scene. And so it kind of makes sense that you'd romanticize it a bit. But
yeah,
I think it's handled kind of as it is in the book. The comedian stuff, this is a thing about Alan Moore. I'm just going to say it. The several books of his, sexual assault kind of comes into the storyline. It's a thing that was dropped in. And if I were to criticize them, and these are tiny, tiny, tiny criticisms. The scene with the comedian and Carla Gugino, the first Silk Spectre, whatever, assault, it goes on and on and on. It's not like a slap and then he tries
to...
He hits her several times, right against the pool table, head on the pool. I mean, he beats the shit out of her. You don't really, even if you have, you get, it's implied in the book, it's not something that needed to go further than the start of it in the film. And then when Rorschach gets the, I think this is in the director's cut, when the psychologist is going through his file and he's trying to tell the guy's life story, his first kill was a man who'd abducted a child. And and in the book it's a machete or a cleaver, and a cleaver comes down and you're out. In the movie, it's like multiple strikes in silhouette, you know, from the side. So I thought some of those choices were kind of like a little, taking it a little too far. Very much.
That's what I was trying to get at.
Yeah.
Okay. Is there's points where he lingers, and you know, just like he does the slow-mos of certain characters and stuff, it's like, I don't think you were supposed to have these incredible scenes of Silk Spectre and Night Owl, you know, beating the I don't think that's the point, you know, this glorified, bloody, incredible action scene. Bones, I think this skin, yeah, blood, I think the point of that is this is getting them off, you know. And so I didn't really see a point, because if you look at that sequence in the book, there's no sounds. It's just little vignettes of them beating up these guys and then making out. Yeah. And that's what I meant by tone. I just meant some of the stuff he said the loud part, or the loud part quiet and the quiet part loud.
Yeah,
it's
almost not, it's not torture porn, but it's like this is going to get off a certain, you know, element. This is really a serious, I'm not going to shy away from the violence kind of thing, but it ends up being distracting. And I know this is the one of the things, no pun intended, that everybody points to, no pun intended, when they criticize the film. Dr. Manhattan, full frontal. Starkers.
That doesn't bother me at all.
Doesn't bother me, but as a choice, you go, yeah, have it, but don't linger, because if you linger, it's all anybody's going to talk about, and it became such a thing that everybody talked about and everybody made jokes about. Still do. It's still, when they talk, oh, CGI, if it's not as bad as Dr. Manhattan's dong and. It has been, you know, a 10-year...
Can we call it a tallywhacker?
10-year joke. And so from a creative standpoint, I'd go, he's in the background. He's walking this way, cut to something else. And by the time he gets here, you're already at the waist. And the reason...
Or they could do like the, you know, the Benny Hill gags where he keeps opening a garden gate.
Right. Stuff just going past him. Like a trolley goes past him.
He's got a big French baguette.
Here's a skyscraper when he's big, and here's a baguette when he's going to lunch. But, you know, the reason Dr. Manhattan wears the diaper thing, the black thing, is because he has no qualms, obviously, but it's because it makes other people uncomfortable. And again, this is not me being a prude or something. That has nothing to do with it. It has to do with it became a distraction. And the first time you see him, you're in awe of, like, it's Dr. Manhattan. Oh my God, I'm seeing him, you know, in the flesh, so to speak, for the first time. And then it's like, you know, you get this thing in your face and in widescreen. So I always thought that was another aspect of Snyder, very much like the violence going, yeah, I'm going full throttle. Like, here it is right in your face. Nothing you can do about it. This is an R-rated, naked superhero movie. Just deal with it. You
know, it's your problem.
What is your it's just a dong, man. That I think goes along with the violence, where it's like, that's a very Randian kind of, you know, just you know, if you're gonna, you know, give blood, play hockey, you know, one of those t-shirts or something. So I totally get in those little moments where it's like, yeah, that was a bit much. You could have implied that. And watching it again recently, there's plenty of stuff that isn't there. Like I say, the mask. You never understand what that mask is, what the cloth is.
It just, oh, they don't explain it. Yeah.
They explain it. It's never explained. they get to the meat of the conversations. There's very little fat in that movie. I mean, it is, and I, you know, again, just like the first time that, you know, when the first X-Men came out or, you know, whatever, and people, well, it should have been, it could, yeah, but you gotta have to always think about the people that are going into this thing that have no idea what it is. And if you went into Watchmen, as my then partner did at the time when we went to see it, had never read it, she didn't know what it was. I explained a little bit of what it was. She couldn't stop talking about it. Like, she just thought, oh my God. Weeks she'd be like, I can't stop thinking about that story and just the, and she got it. I mean, there were moments where you'd explain a few things after the fact because I knew the story so well. But it is, you know, here's the other thing. Looking at the DVD, and this was the good old days when a studio would put out a DVD in 2009, and it was loaded with extras.
Oh yeah. Like
a documentary about the book itself and a documentary about the sets and another thing. And then all the online mini journals that they would put out before the movie came out. And those are each like 20 minutes long. Now you get a new movie. It's got, you know, it's loaded with extras, and you get the thing, and there's like
the interactive menu.
There's five extras, and each one is about 3 minutes long. And then the end of that extra shows the logo of the film and saying available right now. And yeah, I know it's available on DVD. I'm watching it right now.
My favorite is the stills galleries. No one ever goes through those, do they?
Nobody does. Yeah. Nobody does the stills galleries. And,
yeah.
And
or trailers from other films. Oh, thanks.
Oh, thanks. Thanks. I hated this one. Why are you showing me more? But it's funny. It doesn't have the trailers on it. So I went to look them up. This is like a week ago or so. There was an advance trailer that was very good. It had a Smashing Pumpkins song on it. I'm not a Smashing Pumpkins person. I've never liked
it. Yeah, but they it was the Batman Forever, or was it Batman and Robin? It was a parody. Like what it was they took a Smashing Pumpkins song and they slowed it down. But that was the Batman and Robin or Batman Forever music.
Okay, so there
and
you
that
go.
Was kind of like a middle finger to comic book movies, which I liked. I liked that a lot.
Okay, it's like I say, that first one is a good trailer. The regular trailer, I would advise everyone when you're done listening to this, go and look up the regular trailer for Watchmen on YouTube. It is one of the best trailers of the last 20 years. It is so. If you, and again, going through it, thinking of people that know, people that are excited for it, but also someone that's looking at this that has no idea what this story is, who these characters are, it sells it. It so sells it. And then the midway point, there's a song start by Muse. It's off of, it's the first track on Black Holes and Revelations. And it's got this, you know, this keyboard. It's like almost kind of like Pink Floyd. And from that moment, you know, the words are coming at you like, you know, from the most celebrated graphic novel of all time. And then it ends with Rorschach, you know, then they'll, you know, then I'll look back down and whisper, no. And then his face, you get a shot of his face and the mask changes. And I remember people just screaming in the theater when they saw that trailer. It is an incredibly effective trailer. And that's when I, you know, prior to it coming out, that's when I went, oh my God, this is going to be much better than I could have hoped that it was going to be. So I think I saw it in the theater. I think I might've seen it like four times in the theater.
Really? I saw it once, but 2009, my kids were really young. And I'm pretty sure that, you know, going to the movies was a rare occasion. So I just snuck out by myself.
Right.
I think I went to like the 9 o'clock show. So I got home at like 1 a.m.
Your wife's like going to get milk. You're like, I'll be right back. She's going to get some milk.
No, she was like, this was not a sitter moment. She was like, no, just go, you know.
I think I saw it the second time was because my then partner wanted to see it again. And so we went. And then I went with a buddy who hadn't seen it. And then I think I saw it again on my own. So I just ate it up, you know, and then that's when we started to get some merchandise. We got, because, oh, we're missing a bit here. For the 10th anniversary, so 96, 97 or whatever it was, DC Direct was going to the action figures.
Yes, yeah, they were in Toy Fair. They're DC Direct. Yeah, I remember those.
Yes, and a guy named Tim Bruckner, who was the first guy that we reached out to do the sculpts for our first figures, but that is a very long story. He's a nice enough guy, but that's a really long story. But Bruckner was a recommendation from Alex because he had done a lot of the Kingdom Come stuff for Alex's Kingdom Come action figure line. He sculpted those. And they're beautiful. It was going to be Dr. Manhattan, Silk Spectre, and the Comedian. And they get solicited, but then Alan Moore comes along and says, I'm not signing off on this.
Yeah.
They owe me some royalties or something, and until we get that. And the book has never gone out of print.
That's the sticking point, is he was supposed to own the characters.
Yeah.
If the book went out of print. And, well, you know, that would only work if it wasn't successful. And, you know, that was very naive of him, but I understand.
Yeah.
You know,
well, I look at it as filmmaking too, or like sad to say, like design or anything, you know, you want to keep working. You want things to be successful so you can keep working, but it's other people's money and budget, and everything else that you're coming into play in. And the trade-off usually isn't. He would be no different than most of the British invasion from the 60s. People that, you know, signed contracts that didn't get to do. That was it. The book has never gone out of print, and you know, all these generations are going to it, and people keep recommending it, and so.
I'm of two minds on it. But yeah, that's his sticking point. I understand that. And that, you know, that combined with some legal troubles, I believe, in the adaptation of League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, which was very scarring for him to be accused of stealing something that, you know, he didn't even write as a film, as a screenplay, were scarring to him. And they jaded him.
Yeah.
And to his credit, he's a man of his principles, because he's turned down dump trucks of money. You know, crazy.
That's the part that really sticks with me, though, where it's like he has been left leaning his whole life. He is very about the community of Northampton and it's, you know, trying to rebuild, you know, put energy into it and, you know, get industry back. But it's so, you know, it's even to this day, it's not the town that it used to be, blah, blah, blah. It started with him saying, I'm not going to be involved with this, but you can do the thing and I don't want to know. And then it became, you know what, this next thing, don't even put my name on it. So people don't even know I did it. Don't even put my name on it, but I'll take the money. And then it became, don't put my name on it and I don't want the money either. And that's where I go, really, dude, take their money. Put it towards some community thing, like, you know, use them somehow. That part I've always kind of, you know,
disagreed. Yeah, make some good with the money. I know what you're saying.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that always kind of that always kind of bums me out. But he's, you know, he is what he is. But somehow the movie gets made, and then we get merchandise.
Yeah. Did you want to just briefly talk about the David Hayter test footage? Because I didn't want to gloss over that, where we've got two different actors doing Dryburgh and Rorschach.
Yeah.
But one of the guys is from Game of Thrones, and I forget who's in the Rorschach. I think it's the guy who played the Punisher. Thomas Jane, the second Punisher. Ray Stevenson. Yeah, that's it. And Ian Glenn, who ended up playing Batman on the Titans show.
That's right.
And I loved his character on Game of Thrones. Those two. It was pretty decent. It looked like that could have been a decent film as well, because the tone's right.
Well, and also David Hayter co-wrote the screenplay, and he was, I think he's co-screenwriter of X-Men 1 and X-2. He's done mostly television since, but I think, man, that's 3 for 3. I think he's an actor, or maybe he started as an actor. Now he does produces TV as well. But like, those are 3 solid outings. You know, Sam Hamm doesn't even have 3 solid outings for scripts. But it's funny because it's just one of those things that I don't think people think about, like his name being attached to 3. It was a different world in, you know, 2000 to 2008, 2009, those things, you know, getting made.
Well, yeah, the difference is Marvel. Game changed the whole thing. Right. When you look at superhero movies from the early 2000s, they're kind of all over the place.
Yes, and they're not unified, you know.
Yeah, you got Catwoman. the greatest film ever made.
You can't help yourself, can you? Like, you gotta.
No.
Every 2 episodes, you gotta. I think you've got stake in it. Did you get points for that? Did you get a few points?
Someday it'll break even.
Fucking hell. So we get DC Direct does a line of, you get buttons and T-shirts and notebooks and journals and posters and a line of action figures that have very limited articulation, but they're good sculpts. They're decent. They made several different Dr. Manhattans, 2 different Rorschachs, 1 without the mask when he gets arrested, 2 different comedians, young comedian and
because everyone loves the young comedian's outfit.
Everybody loves that bastard. Silk Spectre, both Silk Spectres, young Night Owl, and I think that's it. Oh, and one of my favorite things that I have out on Blu-ray, Amazon did an exclusive set, which is the Owl Ship, and it comes on a base that's got like waters or smoke kind of coming up where you click it on there, and underneath the base is where the DVDs are. But the Owl Ship is like a toy, and you press these 2 buttons, or this button on top of it, and the 2 lights, the windows light up, and it makes a flying sound, which is very freaking cool. I never ever thought we'd get an Archimedes Owl Ship.
It's weird to have any of it. I remember, you know, there was a Rorschach doll at Toys R Us, like a 12-inch doll, and it looked really nice, but I was like, wow, I can't believe this exists. Because it, you know, it almost, how do I put this? It almost seems like it shouldn't, because that was the point of the movie, you know, that the Ozymandias is making merchandise, and, you know, it's just an interesting.
I mean, that meta right there, like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, completely. I mean, they did 12-inch figures of Dr. Manhattan, the comedian, and Rorschach. I think there might have been a Silk Spectre that was done by a Japanese company, not DC Direct. I could be wrong about that, but I seem to recall that. The Rorschach.
What do you think of the casting of the film in that regard?
I think the casting is outstanding. I think it's.
Yeah.
I think Patrick Wilson has never stopped working from the time he showed up and the first thing he did. He's so good, and he's so good looking.
That was one of my quibbles was, you know, Dreiberg's supposed to be chubby and overweight, you know, you're like schlubby. And the best they could do was try to make him look like Clark Griswold.
Well, that's the thing. Like, I mean, who are you going to get that's, you know, it's tricky because he was a name in the sense that it meant quality. He'd already, you know, been in some, you know, award nominated things. And I think Angels in America had already come out. And so, you know, I don't know who that would have been. Like, who are you going to get? Like Adrian Brody to be.
Drawn? True. True. Yeah. No, please don't.
So it's tricky.
I think he did a great job. I think his Night Owl is. What's that?
I'm glad they didn't do like, you know, a different nose, like prosthetics on the face and made it a little
scowlier. Well, speaking of that, though, can we just talk about the worst Nixon in a movie ever?
I'm glad you brought this up because I have a theory about some of this stuff. But go ahead.
Okay, that thing is the love child of the kid catcher from Chitty Chitty Bang Bang with the judge from Nothing But Trouble. Like, it's off-putting.
But it's weird about it is it's not just the prosthetics. It's the voice. It's the way he sounds like he's got a mouthpiece in. He sounds like he's wearing, you know, you can almost hear when he speaks the air coming out of his mouth hitting the rubber on the mask almost, or on the prosthetic. It's just it's really a strange choice, because I think some of it, when you think about some of the stuff that Moore puts in there, some of the humor, some of the kind of asides that are darkly humorous, or the obvious things, the big thing, you know, like the, I think some of his stuff is broad. Some of his stuff is almost, you know, commedia dell'arte kind of stuff. And I always wondered if maybe some of the bigger type things that are more obvious in the film was kind of addressing that. Like, you know, this is obviously, we're just getting someone that looks, I mean, Kissinger too, like he's kind of cartoony. He looks better than Nixon, but he's sort of cartoony. Or, you know, even like there's a shot when you're going through the opening credits. You got it.
Fantastic.
Unbelievable opening credits. Yeah. But there's a shot of Ozymandias, and Matthew Good is someone, the first thing I saw him in was a Woody Allen movie called Match Point, which is a fantastic movie. It is very Hitchcock. That's the first thing I ever saw him in. And then I would just find him in things, because he was so naturally convincing in this part that he had. So I was happy with him, because he's handsome, and he's got the cheekbones, and he's
great. I liked him because I'd never seen him in anything before. Yeah. So he just became the character to me. A lot of the, you know, I love the girl playing Silk Spectre. She's, she's too beautiful for the role, but that doesn't really matter to me. You know,
she looks every scene, however they shot, even the dinner scene with the two of them, she is really stunning in that movie. But Matthew Good, from my understanding, is playing it a little bit like Bowie. He's not doing a Bowie accent, but he's kind of playing it a little sort of, he is above this world, kind of, than having these normal sort of conversations. He's just on a different sort of level. So there's a shot in the opening credits where you push in on him outside of Studio 54. Over his shoulder is obviously David Bowie and Mick Jagger.
Yeah.
But Bowie is literally dressed like Ziggy Stardust. He's dressed like he just got back from the BBC and shot, you know, did a song on Top of the Pops, you know, jumpsuit with a star. It's over the top. It's over the top. You know that's Bowie, or supposed to be Bowie, but it's ridiculous to think that he'd be walking around in a spaceman outfit to go to, you know. So I feel like there's these moments in it that are kind of obvious, sort of. Even some of the wigs, like some of the reporter that interviews Ozymandias.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like they just stuck a mustache on him before he could put his coat on and slap.
Is that the one who does the gotcha with Dr. Manhattan?
Yeah, okay, that's a great one. Yeah. The gotcha with Joni or Jeannie, whatever her name is.
Yeah, yeah.
When she comes out like, I told you I love you. I said I'd do anything. And then pulling off the... That's a big soap opera, you know, middle of the day soap opera type moment in the book. It's over the top, and they treat it over the top in the scene as well. I feel like there's times where he's faithful, but he's also going. It does get kind of broad too, in moments. There are times of intimacy, and then there's broad stuff.
I just wonder where they got a Donald Sutherland impersonator. For that scene.
Well, he does. But when you see the photographer he's being interviewed, it's clearly riffing on Annie Leibovitz. That's who she's supposed to look like. So when I see it, I go, is this guy supposed to be somebody? Is it supposed to be like, he looks like Kurt Vonnegut.
I get that too. Yeah.
You know, but what are you kind of riffing on? I think Crudup is fantastic. I mean, he's great in his scenes as before he turns, you know. But just his sort of the balance in his voice and the calmness and everything is just so. And then when you kind of get to the climax, when he decides to help, when he understands what her history is, her past and everything, some emotion comes in, or when he yells, you know, leave me alone kind of thing. Like, I think he's great. Rorschach steals it, obviously. Jeffrey Dean Morgan is someone that I like him, he's great in it, and I like a lot of stuff that he's done. I can't do Walking Dead after that first season with him. But he's kind of big and broad, you know?
He's over the top, but, you know, he gets the job done. Mm-hmm. I think that character was supposed to be kind of a bit over the top, you know?
Just the thing with in the bar with the pregnant woman in Vietnam. Yeah. When he jumps off the plane and Dreiberg's going, what happened? We were supposed to help, you know, and every line is like a line reading rather than him really putting a lot into it. Morgan kind of, he keeps it very kind of one dimensional. But you know who's freaking great in it too is Matt Frewer.
Yeah. Yeah. I was hoping you'd get there because I love Matt Frewer, and it's a tiny role.
Yep.
And he just nails it.
And boy, your Canadian fella that I like so much, he plays the older Night Owl. What's his name? Oh, come on. Canadian. He's a legend. He's married.
You know what?
He was in. Remember that movie I kept telling you to watch called Pontypool?
Oh, I know what you're talking about.
Stephen something. Just these amazing, weird features in his nose.
Stephen McCaddy, yeah.
McCaddy, freaking great in everything he's in. He does a great job. So I was cool with the casting.
Yeah, he was amazing on Orphan Black, which stars Tatiana Maslany, who's She-Hulk. Right. For the record, liked the show. I think Matt Frewer was the villain on Orphan Black.
I think She-Hulk is fine. I just can't decide if it's a full-on sitcom, and if it's a sitcom, it's a sitcom I probably wouldn't watch other than wanting to see this Marvel character. And I don't know much about her. I didn't read the book, but I'm going with it. I thought the one with Wong and the magician guy doing the magician in the courthouse was fun. I thought that was great.
Yeah, that was great. I don't know what people expect from She-Hulk, but I was expecting it to be kind of a romp like the 80s comic was, you know.
I was actually expecting more of a romp. Let's put it that way. That's a good way to put it. I thought it was going to sort of swing for the fences, you know.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think my issue with it was that it it doesn't go far enough. It could go sillier. I don't think that would stop the hate. Because I just read some stuff and I'm like, well, what were you thinking it was going to be? Like, you just want monster fighting?
I saw a day that had a video that was literally Andor had premiered on a Wednesday. This guy must put the video up Wednesday night, and it literally said it had him on. It's his face. He's got a little goatee, George Lucas-y kind of black hair, up glasses, and the title is.
Fail.
I don't like Andor .. and why I'm done with Star Wars.
And until next week.
And done is in capital letters. And I kid you not, I couldn't help myself but to click on it. And as I'm listening to him, he goes, you know, it's always that preamble of like, now look, I need to clarify.
That's the whole thing bad.
And
unfortunately it works. We've got to change our show.
The best part of it says, and that is why, I am done with Star Wars for the foreseeable future, at least.
Yeah. Until the next wave of Star Wars black figures comes out. Yeah.
Like, you are never going to be done with Star Wars. Give me. So even things that are like, I went to the screening of Andor, like the last Friday, it was like a they showed all three of the episodes at Disney. And, I'm biased because I love Tony Gilroy's writing. And I thought it was great. I'm like, okay, this is I want to see some characters that you just, everybody, but those, I feel like those negative, the She-Hulk people, the same people that criticize, I don't know those people. I don't know. I don't talk to people that have those kinds of feelings. And I wonder sometimes if they're a 5% of this base that just has the biggest megaphone that's screaming about this stuff, because it sells, it gets people to click and everything, or really if like, you know, 30%, 40% of the Marvel and Star Wars whatever audience just despise all this, because none of it's failing, you know, it's all making money.
Yeah.
So I don't get it. I don't get
it. It's also, you know, I think to a lot of these folks, it's healthy to take a break from things. I am currently not watching Doctor Who, but that's okay because I might again soon. And
you stopped listening to Christopher Cross.
That's not true. That's impossible.
I got to walk away. I'm getting too close.
He's been living here for a little while.
I'm caring too much about Cross's third album. Yeah, it is good, but they're never going to walk away. They're never going to leave it alone.
I mean, it's not everything has to be for me.
Exactly. Look at the bulk, the volume of stuff we're getting. It's like, I'll find something to dig, you know, and just as long as I'm getting fantasy and sci-fi and, you know, spy things or whatever, like, bring it on. I'll see it all. I don't have to love it all, but I'm grateful that we have it. So the movie comes out. The movie does well.
It didn't do super well, though.
It didn't do super well. But again, it's a 3-hour movie.
Yeah, it's a beast. It's a lot.
It's a 3-hour R-rated, hard R-rated. Yeah. You can't get a huge percentage of the, like, I'm saying that somebody else could have grabbed this thing, and I guarantee they would have made a 90-minute to 2-hour PG-13 film. And even if, you know, it was tonally different and whatever, it would have done much better. It was an expensive movie. They really sprung for this thing.
Yeah.
But it
shows on the screen.
It completely shows. I think it would have done better if it had more screenings each day and it wasn't R-rated. But I think
it's one of those things that also probably had, what was it? I was watching a documentary about cult films. And Hedwig and the Angry Itch?
Mm-hmm.
And the director said the film studio said, you know, it didn't do all that great in the theaters.
Mm-hmm.
But the studio put a lot into the DVD and told the director it's going to have a long life. And I think Watchmen is one of those films that has a long life. People buy it, you know.
In fact, I think it was right where the turn, because the turn to me was about 2005 or so, when people were starting to understand that, you know, Big Lebowski didn't do that great, you know, when it came out. But given it a few years and all of a sudden it's turning, and also where the studios were going, we're going to do pretty good with this movie. We're going to do even better when it hits, because DVD was, you know, and still is an ongoing thing. People, I think, tend to not, because you don't see it commercially out at stores much. It is a constantly growing industry. DVD and Blu-ray is huge. The market's huge. Like, there's actually so much stuff. So I think, and I think it did very well. I saw a little thing on Bone Tomahawk the other day. Did you see Bone Tomahawk?
I've been meaning to. I think I know what that is.
S. Craig Zeller, I think, did it. He got Kurt Russell. He got Rick Jenkins. He got whatever. He got to direct it because he kept putting his foot down. And he kept having to take concessions for it. I think it was $1.2 million budget. They shot this thing in 21 days. That's my understanding. They shot this Western with all those people and the availability lined up, because people had to drop out because it took years to get the financing, get it going. And it just went poof when it came out. But the DVD sales were like over 4 million for this thing. It took on another life on DVD. So I think you're absolutely right. I think Warner Brothers went, even if we do okay with this, we're going to do really well with the ancillary stuff. And I think that's why then you get the director's cut, and then you get, you know, so I have the only version, the only thing I have, I think, that has the original version on it is a box set that came out that has the graphic novel with it and the movie, I think, or something else. There also was Best Buy had two different face, case DVDs. They had a Rorschach. It came in a clear box and you had Rorschach flip it open. Like a makeup compact.
Mm-hmm.
So they did a Rorschach, they did a Dr. Manhattan. Then you get the director's cut that came out. You had the Blu-ray one that has the owl ship. Then, you know, 6 months after the director's cut came out, I think we got the ultimate cut, where it's the director's cut, and he edited in the Tales from the Black Freighter in there as well. Tales from the Black Freighter and Under the Hood came out as a separate DVD prior to the film. But there was also, like, a year before the movie, there was the motion comic.
Yeah. Yeah, I watched some of that.
3 hours long. So they really were, they really got behind this thing. So anyway, so now we get that, we do the movie. Then the next thing I think that happens is Matty Collector does the Watchmen figures.
Oh, I forgot about those. Yeah.
They come in a box, and when you line the boxes up, it says who watches the Watchmen on your shelf. Like, I don't know who would do that. If you're a nerd, then you would do that. That's what it says. Like, I'm just kidding. They're right over here.
No, it's one of the things about the film I don't like is that they're called the Watchmen when they never were in the film or in the book.
Yeah. Yeah. It doesn't. Yeah. I mean, which I totally understand. And I also completely understand the change of the ending. It makes perfect sense. I'm completely on board with it.
I was too, because it's a 3-hour film.
You would never have enough time to explain plan or where this thing came from, etc. So, and I should also say I've done a video on it for Plastic Soul. And of course, everyone, as I know, that's listening has subscribed to Plastic Soul.
If they haven't, we're going to scold you.
If you haven't, you should do it now. It's no time like the present. I did a video about stuff that I've got collectibles from Watchmen. They did some promotional stuff that never made it out commercially. One was a pair of night owl sunglasses that came in a plastic case shaped like the owl ship, which I don't have. It was like you'd enter a contest. They did a white hoodie that you could zip all the way up and it would make your face look like Rorschach. Came in a box. They did blue condoms for Watchmen. They were promotional condoms. Ha ha ha. They did a little owl ship keychain, which I have, that you press the little button on the head and it does white light out the eyes. Press the other little side of the button and it gives you the Watchmen logo in yellow on the wall. And a watch, a flip up face watch. That has the face of it looks like the owl ship, and on the right side is the clock, and on the left side there's another little clock that's always 5 minutes to doomsday, always 5 minutes to midnight.
Oh, that's not fun.
Those are cool. So now we get the Matty Collector stuff. Of course, I got all that. And then, when did you first kind of hear that we were getting this series, the HBO series?
Well, I think the comic book came first, right? Like they DC started
Yeah, I'm kidding.
And
before Watchmen stuff.
Watchmen stuff, and I'm not a fan of it. I mean, I've heard mixed reviews. Some stuff's good, some stuff's bad. I just didn't think that. I thought it should just rest, but you know, DC needs to keep these, you know, their corporation, and they got some talented people, but I didn't follow that. I didn't go for that. And I was highly skeptical of the HBO series, too. I thought, oh, no, they're dragging this corpse, you know?
Yeah. Well, let's go to the comic, because I completely forgot about those comics.
I didn't read them. So
I started to read one of them and I kind of gave up. And so in the years since, I've managed to find all the trades. Like at Amoeba, when I go to Amoeba, it's like $8. So I'm like, okay, I can do it. So I've now read the Comedian one, the Silk Spectre one. I'm reading the Dr. Manhattan one. I read the Rorschach one, the Night Owl one, I think. So there's one and a half left, kind of. And they're kind of, you know, they're fine, but it's like there's nothing. You can't help but just compare to what's come prior. Then there was one called Doomsday Clock.
Yeah, I bought the first issue of that and forgot all about it.
You thought before Watchmen was bad.
Didn't Doomsday Clock take forever to do?
It took forever to do, written by Geoff Johns, mixing other DC characters with the Watchmen characters. It was just, I don't even remember it. It was so, I won't even get into it. But that happened. But I will say this, there's a Rorschach miniseries, and I think it's post the show, maybe? It is post the show. I would recommend the Rorschach mini, just called Rorschach. It was like anything that is the closest in tone and art direction to the original book of any of that stuff. It's actually quite, if you'd ever check that out. But I don't remember when I first heard about the show, but I'm with you. I just went, this can't be a good idea. Like, what is this?
And originally I thought, are they going to just redo the book? Because I'm down with that. Seeing a more faithful adaptation of the book would, you know, in a long. But no, then I found out, no, it's 30 years later. And I thought, okay. And I gave it a watch. And I have to tell you that I think it is a worthy successor.
I couldn't agree more. I remember them being cagey about it, because when Lindelof would get asked, it would be like, yeah, is it a remake? Is it a thing? And they'd give these vague
answers. I didn't have a lot of faith in Lindelof either. You keep
it within the universe of blah, blah, blah. Well, that's the thing. Lindelof, you know, my association is with Lost and the stuff that we tried to do, because he wanted us to, because he loved Dexter, and that's how we got that license and all that. And my understanding was, you know, there's no follow through. There was never like a follow through with anything that I'd seen that he'd done. So I was skeptical of that too. But from the first episode on, I was just like, whoa, you know, what's going on? I mean, cause it is, you don't know what's going on. The first two or three episodes, you have no idea what's going on. And then having seen it all, you know, front to back, it's, I think it's incredible. I think it's actually a very worthy successor. And loaded with Easter eggs, just loaded with, you know, there's one where Looking Glass, Tim Blake Nelson,
mm-hmm.
is at a support group for people that clearly have anxiety about the squids, or that were there on the day that it happened in 85, and you know, they're still having flashbacks and you know, all this stuff. And a woman comes in and he turns around and says, "Friend of Nemo's," you know, like an AA meeting, you know, I'm a friend of Bill's. And little things like that it's just kind of peppered with. And then they go out for a beer after, and she's talking about a movie called Pale Horse.
Yeah, and right.
I didn't see it. She goes, "Steven Spielberg, Pale Horse." Da, da, da. Well, Pale Horse was the band
mm-hmm.
you keep seeing posters of. So it's just filled with stuff like that. And I love that. And
well, what I like about it, too, is it is not the movie universe. This is the comic.
Well, I would say it is the comic, but there are definite nods to the film. And I off the top of my head, I can't think of anything right now, but I remember talking to Alex about this, where like there were these three or four little winks to the audience that I'm like, that's a film reference. Like that's a little something that's saying we're in the same kind of universe. We're just, you know, we're telling it slightly differently, kind of. But yes, it is mostly a sequel to, you know, that the giant squid version of events. What did you think about the wrap up? What did you think about when you get to the end? Did you think it satisfied? Were you satisfied by the end?
Yeah, I mean, I'm just trying to remember it, because I only watched it once, and it was a lot, because it really does take certain things out of the book, you know, like the identity of Hooded Justice.
Yeah.
And do some really interesting things with it. And the thing I like best about it is, and I know a lot of people, you know, I read some people that were upset about the politics of it and that sort of thing, but I think it should upset you.
Yeah.
I think it should challenge you, because the original upset you and challenged you. You're just used to it now. So I kind of liked what he did there, and I can't believe how well it was done. The ending was a little, you know, rushed, I guess, but
okay.
It works. It all works. And I really respected that Lindelof's like, "No, we're done. We're not doing another one." So that's it. You know,
I want more. I selfishly.
Oh,
want.
I do too. But that's okay. We can want more.
Yeah.
That's the point, I guess.
I think it got like, I want to say 11 or 12 like Emmy nominations. It was the record that year for number of nominations. I think there were several that it won. I think it won like four or five. But it was the best reviewed show of the year. Like it just people were hooked to this thing. And again, you're thinking in terms of, did you ever feel like someone could sit down and watch this having never read the book or seen the film?
I think that would be a challenge. I don't think my wife liked it. My son and I liked it. Okay. Which was odd because I thought she would really be into, she's usually into these kind of shows. It's tough for me. I was hooked, and I'm a very rare guy to get hooked on a show. I'm kind of like a commitment weirdo. But I really needed to know how these pieces fit together. Mm-hmm. And then there was just so many good, performances in the show.
Gene
Smart is so good in it. Regina King is great. And, I loved Tim Blake Nelson's character. I think he was probably my favorite character.
Yeah.
Almost like the opposite of Rorschach.
Yes.
And Jeremy Irons is so fun in this. His whole story, you know, you're spending like, you know, 8 episodes trying to figure out like, what the hell is he doing and where is he? You know, like what is going on?
Yeah.
And, you know, I didn't totally figure it out until they told me.
Exactly.
And the other thing I really liked was the Rorschach, the idea that Rorschach was now a symbol for these guys, that was fantastic.
And a lot of people had a problem with that. See, it goes back to what you said earlier. A lot of people thought that, you know, you're already taking this beloved character in a way and you're turning it into something else now. And I don't like that you've done that to the character, sort of thing. But it makes sense. That's what would happen.
It happens in real life.
It happens. And in fact, you know, I this is what got this whole thing kicked off was I get to these states of mind where I just kind of go, I need to watch something and not really think about it. I just want to be immersed and not think about the world right now. And I went back to watch the Watchmen series. So I got about halfway through and I thought, I'm going to watch the movie again. I might even read the book again. And that's how we're talking about it now. But yeah. Watching it again, holy shit. I mean, in this country, at least, in light of recent events, it is even more prescient, if you will, like the things that are going on and the possibility.
And the thing is it's also not it's not biased to one political side.
No.
There's serious problems with the Redford presidency.
Well, go ahead.
No, it's critical, you know, it's a real world in that regard. It's not our world.
Well,
but
that's what I think is one of the most incredible things that it does, you know, to honor the original material. By the time you get to the end of the original story, you know who the villain is, but at the same time you're going, yeah, but, you know, did it save billions of people? And what would the alternative have been?
Yeah.
It's very cloudy what the morality is when you get to the end of that story. And I think they did a really good job in, you know, little things like, you know, Vietnam, you know, the making that part. I think that was like part of the United States or something. Like, parallel weird things in the book, Nixon's third term, whatever. They expanded on that with the show, the squids and, you know, just all that stuff. But man, when you get into the home stretch of those last couple of episodes and everything starts to get, you go backwards and you see what a beautiful puzzle it is and how it clearly was mapped out from the first, because again, watching it again, there are even lines of dialogue that you're like, oh, that was some foreshadowing. And that was that, you know, she knows what she knows, but they don't know what she just said. And I know what she's referring to. And really, really beautifully put together. The music is fantastic too.
Music by
is it Trent Reznor and somebody?
Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross, yeah.
It's amazing. Just this moody, and Don Johnson. Like, if anything, I wanted more Don Johnson in it because he's perfect. He's just perfect in every Everyone with Louis Gossett.
What it was Don Johnson's like career now? He's just playing racists. He's a Django Unchained.
Django. But I love that. I love that Tarantino goes, you know, it's easy to make a joke of Miami Vice. It's easy to think about the pastel colors and the espadrilles and the, you know, the 80s hits and everything. First couple seasons of Miami Vice is a stunning, stunning show. It's doing things on network television that hadn't been done. And guys like Tarantino go, no, he's really good. Like, he really, you know, he's the focal point of the cop show, and he's really good in it. He's, who was this guy? Nobody knew really who he was. He'd been around, but, you know, I believe actually I read Mickey Rourke was considered for the Sonny Crockett part in 84, but he turned it down, which is another insane alternate universe. Like, what would that universe have been like? So I kind of love that he's got these, you know, he's showing up in Knives Out, and, you know, Tarantino wants him. He actually is in another movie done by the same guy who wrote and directed Bone Tomahawk. He's in a movie with Mel Gibson and Vince Vaughn. And
there really isn't a bad performance in the show. I really enjoy it. Yeah. I like all the little characters. Like, I like Red Menace and that whole notion of cops have to be superheroes and wear masks. It's bizarre, but it kind of works for the film. And I'm a big fan of that series, and I can't believe I am. I was really expecting to hate it. And I was in, and the beautiful thing is it did not let me down. It left me wanting more, and I like that a lot too.
If there's a disappointment, it would be we didn't get Dan Dreiberg. We didn't get
he's in prison. And then, but you know what? There's some neat, just like The Watchmen itself, the HBO website had all kinds of neat little Easter eggs and tidbits, and there's a beautiful when Dreiberg and I guess, you know, she didn't call herself Silk Spectre. I think she became like the comedian after.
Yeah, Lori.
There's a great interview with the two of them, or with her. And it's, you read it and you're like, yeah, we were funding our missions with selling tech, and didn't you notice that your police cruisers look like owl ships now? And just all this little layers in the, because I would go to the HBO site and look at all that stuff too.
Oh,
and it was like, this is fun, you know, reading the transcripts of her. That was the one that sticks in my mind. There was other stuff, but
okay,
yeah, there was a transcript of her when she got arrested by the FBI. And it was like, oh my God, there's a whole, you know, they're catching you up on what they're doing.
Oh, wow. And, I didn't know it existed. Oh my God. Now I got to dig for this stuff.
But that's one thing I thought that we as the audience could go to is, you know, if you did another season of it, we could get Dreiberg and we could, but I think it told its story and it was done, you know? Yeah, I don't have anything bad to say about it.
Well, it does.
Other than I never figured out who the guy was who sprayed himself with grease and slid into the sewers. I suspect it was Gene Smart's assistant.
Do you think it was?
Yeah.
I forget she sleeps with him.
Yeah, I forgot that.
I forget she knocks on his door one night. She pulls out that, here we go, another joke. She pulls out the Dr. Manhattan equipment in her hotel room, and that's a total reference to the movie. That bit of kit that she has in her hotel room is a total reference to the Snyder film. But people did think that was a fan theory, that he was the guy. But it's just so bizarre when he shows up and hey, what are you doing? You know, Mother Knight's like yelling at him and chasing him, and then just the way he disappears, it's just, and then she asks Looking Glass about him, like, you know, a guy that sprays himself with gasoline. It's so weird. It's got a weirdness to it too. That's you know, and little homages like the newsstand and you know, the
squid rains,
the moon. You know, he lives on the, well, he lives, you never know, he lives on the moon. You know, the moon shot from the beginning of of the credits of Watchmen that's, you know, he's on the moon with, you know, Buzz Aldrin or whoever, and just these little things that are really, it's loaded with great, I mean, the pills are called Nostalgia.
Mm-hmm.
Just shit like that. They really did their homework. And it's an extraordinary piece of television because, but I think whereas the film, you can go into it never having read the book. I do think that. I think if you kind of knew what this thing was and you went into it, I don't think you can start the show without having some background in the story, in the movie or the book. I think you'd be a little confused.
I don't think it would make a whole heck of a lot of sense. You might still enjoy it, but yeah, it's definitely got its, you know, you need to be briefed at least.
Yeah.
I think you could get by if you'd seen the film.
Yeah, if you'd seen the film, I think you'd be okay with the show. But if you haven't seen the film, if you haven't read the book, if you barely know what Watchmen is, I think you're going to be a little, you know, you'd probably be entertained to a degree, but you have no, all the things they're referencing that you have no knowledge of, you know, I think would be a little confusing. They don't really even say who Dr. Manhattan is or who he was or what his powers are. Everyone just knows who he is.
Yeah.
Right there, you're going to be kind of lost if you don't have it.
And I liked the depiction of Dr. Manhattan in this film. It was a different, you know, but it worked for me. And I didn't see that coming either.
Yeah.
And it was interesting.
I'm glad you like it. The one thing that I cannot figure out what the point is or what it's saying. Do you remember you got all the cops in yellow masks, you know who the captain is, you know, and everyone's trying to wear their mask in the office. And then there's the Red Menace guy and there's someone else. Remember the guy that's like dressed like a cop, but he's wearing a panda head?
Oh yeah. No, I didn't know what that was either.
I'm like, what is this character supposed to be? You know, like Johnson at the big meeting says, you know, Panda Bear, whatever his name is, Panda something, read that section 12, the rule about the guns or whatever. And he's just in a cop uniform or like short sleeve shirt, but he's got a panda head. It's just weird. It's just weird. But that's all we got. We didn't get a book, like a making of book. We didn't get any action figures for the show. We didn't get gum cards. We didn't get Pez dispensers. There were a couple.
Well, in Canada, we got, you know, Watchmen cereal with prizes.
Oh, see, that's
no, we didn't do that. I'm kidding.
I wish we did. Yeah. They had at Comic-Con that summer before it aired, they had at the hotel, was certainly the hotel, certainly the luxury hotel that I stayed. They had the hotel keys were Watchmen promos. So one of them got kind of a Dr. Manhattan logo on it, and the other one's got a weird kind of logo on it. So I kept those, but that's about all that was really done for. There aren't even like promotional items that the network sent out. Of course,
I don't own any Watchmen merchandise other than the film and the book. I know Figures Toy Company a while ago announced they would be doing 8-inch Mego scale Watchmen figures, and I was like, that's the sound I made. Ooh. And I thought, yeah, I would love to get a Night Owl and a Rorschach, and you know. And but they tend to be kind of like they announce something and it takes a couple years for it to come out. And I don't know where that's at, or if, you know, or if it got kiboshed. Sometimes things get kiboshed for internal reasons, and so I don't know. I don't know if we're actually ever going to get those.
Maybe
I think
so. Maybe Mego can do it.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if, you know, Mego's got so much stuff going on, I can't see it happening, although I think they do have the DC license, so they could. I always thought Rorschach's pants had to look, you know, would have to be like the Joker's.
Yeah.
You know, the Mego Joker's.
Yeah, purple Joker pants.
Purple Joker, you know, leotards with the shoes, but, you know, what do I know?
You think about the film, like, it's very faithful in many, many ways. The only kind of deviations, is that the term? Is that the word? Rorschach is dead on. Silk Spectre's damn close. But Ozymandias and Night Owl, they made the decision that they had to go a little more 90s kind of with the costumes.
Yeah, I don't actually like. I do think the Night Owl costume looks good. I just think that it's very 90s. With Ozymandias, I always hated his costume anyways, so it didn't really matter.
I agree. I think it looks better in the movie. It's a weird, yeah. weird concoction in the book. But they were saying that they had to dye Rorschach's trousers, his suit, that particular purple to get it to match the book. So it was a custom, you know, custom suit, custom dye.
Yeah, I know Snyder walked around the set holding the book.
Mm.
So he was really trying. And it shows. I mean, like I said, he was probably the right director for it because he got a lot of it right.
Yeah.
And I think it's, you know, like, I think where he really falls into the weeds is trying to do Batman and Superman, even though I loved his Justice League for, you know, so
I'll go a step further and say, again, this is nothing against anyone that likes whatever you like. I sometimes can't believe the guy that did those three films, especially Watchmen, is the same guy making the stuff he's making. Because it's, I mean, Watchmen's subtle compared to, you know, Batman versus Superman, yeah, you know, Man of Steel, Batman versus Superman, Justice League, you know. It's all just, you know, it's just of the same kind of concoction. It's weird to me because you see the effort and care taken with this thing. And not even that dark. I mean, all things considered, it's a dark story, but it's practically day glow compared to, you know, Batman versus Superman. God, does anybody smile?
Yeah, Jeremy Irons.
You know? So there you go. There's our Watchmen. I think we covered all the. I'm sure we forgot something.
I'm sure we did. Yeah. I'm sure people will point that out.
And people will tell us if we did.
But yeah, I don't care if we ever get anything else from this property.
I'm gonna counter that by saying I hope we get everything, even more than we did, and a whole
Watchmen babies.
And a Watchmen animated, although a Watchmen animated series could be really cool too. Like you could keep it in the before or during or whatever. No one would get too uptight about, you know, continuity and whatever. You might have some really creative stuff. Do you ever watch that show on Netflix, The Love and Death and Robots? Have you seen any of that show?
No, I never even heard of it.
Oh my God. They're shorts, different lengths of time. And some of the stuff is just absolutely stunning animation, like little 8-minute thing or, you know, a 15-minute thing or like, you know, from horror type aliens type thing to comedy with a couple of robots on a planet or whatever. It's very heavy metal kind of vibe. But some of the animation is just so stunningly real. It's scary. I could see like Watchmen. Okay. Sorry.
Yeah, I'm good. I mean, sometimes I pick up the movie and I watch it and, you know, it's not a feel good film.
No.
And, it's weird. It's weird to finish that movie and go like, but you know, I like it. I don't know where I'm going with this.
It's
just one of those things where I like it the way it is. I don't need any continuations, any more stories. I was really happy with the television series and I'm completely satisfied that they don't want to bring it back. But that's me.
I'd say this about the film too. In at the time and in hindsight, I don't know what other superhero film you'd compare this to. It is its own thing, not just the subject matter and the characters. But it really is a one-off. Again, that's another aspect. All the praise I've given to the, you know, 2 hours and 45 minutes and no stars and, you know, all this stuff. It also was not a franchise. Studio thing and backed him up. Everything he wanted to do with this, they backed up. Knowing full well, they weren't getting a franchise. And there wouldn't be Happy Meals. And there wouldn't be, You know,
can you imagine?
You know, yeah, I can. I want happiness. But that's an extraordinary achievement. I don't think you could do. I don't even know if you could. If you did it today, it would be a 12-part series on HBO. Like if some, you know, if they ever, and somebody will.
Yeah, it. I would watch a 12-part remake of the series. I wouldn't have any problem with watching that sitting down, but just to see it done the way it was portrayed in the book. Right. But I can't imagine that they could do a straight portrayal. I think it would end up being somewhere along the line because Snyder's came so close. I think they'd have to make some sort of, you know, some sort of creative changes in the same way that, you know, the Sylvester Stallone Judge Dredd movie looks like it leapt off the pages of the comic. And the Carl Urban version reads like you're reading the comic, if you know what I'm trying to say.
That's a good way.
You know, right. You know, so I think somebody would be like, well, we're going to make it exactly like the book, but we're going to, you know, the production's going to be completely off the wall different. And so I think that's what you're going to see. You know, you're going to, if they ever go that route.
I don't think anybody could make something like this again. It is in that pantheon for me of like the Flash Gordon film, you know, certain other things, like it's the Blade Runner. I mean, even though they made a second Blade Runner, but really the original is just, it is what it is. And this one is, you know, it is not a family friendly fun romp, superhero romp. It's a deconstruction and it's dark. There's also a mystery at the core of it. And when you see that, when everyone's going to run now, it's go watch the regular trailer, not the advanced, but the regular, the way that Rorschach's narration is, it's a mystery. It's like someone's killing superheroes and da 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 da. Someone's killing Max. You know, it's got all that, but it's
very film noir.
Film noir. And it wasn't going to lead to a franchise, but someone's going to do a series, I'll bet, at some point. They will do like a 12-part thing. I mean, I just saw a trailer for a Showtime series for Let the Right One In. So we had the original foreign film, Let the Right One In.
We had Let Me In.
Let Me In. And now they're going back to the well. They're telling the same story, but they're making it a series and adding more vampires or a virus or something. So someone's going to do something with Watchmen at some point, and we'll probably be dead, so it won't matter. But but there you go. There's our Watchmen dissertation. That was kind of long, but hey, so was
Watchmen.
I was going to make a Dr. Manhattan joke, but I thought better of it.
Oh, yeah. Well, Dr. Manhattan on a TV series. Anywho.
Yeah, there you go. I hope you've enjoyed that. And please let us know what you think.
Yeah. And you can hit us up in the comments here on YouTube, or you can visit our Facebook group, Pod Stallions. And where there are almost 2,000 people now.
Yeah, and while you're over at YouTube, head on over to the Entertainment Earth YouTube channel and watch Plastic Soul, the show that I host and write and talk about stuff. And why not subscribe?
Hosted by the one that sounds like Mark Hamill, not the one that sounds like Seth Rogen.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm the ugly one that sounds like Mark Hamill.
Oh, sir.
Brian's the handsome fella that sounds like Seth Rogen. It's a dichotomy. Uh-huh. But thank you, everyone. Appreciate your listening, and I hope you enjoyed that. I've learned something.
Yeah, I have too. thanks, everybody, and we'll be back sooner than you know.
Bye.
Bye.